Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions and emails, your calls and your emails, I should say, all here on Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, I always like on around Halloween to do a scary show, and I was trying to think about going through my files for potential scary stories, but then I was also going through my files on the election, and I decided that this election is enough of a scary story because it's really important for people to be good citizens and get out to vote. I wanted to put my little pitch in to please vote. Also, we're going to talk for a few minutes about some of the perhaps not obvious health implications of this upcoming election and the various things that are out there on the table. I want to give thanks in advance to Barbara Springer and Michael Corral for their assistance in setting up this little discussion. And let's start with just talking about some of the candidate races. Meg Whitman, interestingly enough, on the ballot for governor of California, has said that she'll direct the attorney general to fight any healthcare financing reform packages that come through. And, well, aside from the fact that we're not yet in a police state and you can't actually direct the attorney general to do anything, it makes her position clear. With respect to Carla Fiorini, she's vowed to reverse healthcare financing reform. And the polls, as you are undoubtedly aware, show that 52% of people oppose the current package. And if you read the fine print, more than half of that 52% actually opposes it because they don't think it's enough. I would have to say I'm in that group. Others oppose it because they're not sick, or they resist the mandate, or they have ideological reasons for not wanting to have us bring ourselves in line with the rest of the planet. But let's go on to the California propositions, and apologies to those listeners who are out of state, but I'm sure similar issues are on your state ballot. And the principle here is to kind of look behind the immediate things that you see in the little executive summary of the ballot and think about the implications and the system that we currently have and how a proposition vote might affect it. So in an effort to model that type of thinking, let's talk about Proposition 19. That's the marijuana legalization. I won't go into too much detail, but there's a little clause in that that limits the amount of growing space that a person has to 25 square feet, which, if you know anything at all about gardening, is pretty much setting that up as a hydroponics production, not an outdoor production. And arguably, what you can grow, according to my sources, in 25 square feet may not actually be enough to supply the needs of even a single individual annually. Now, I'm very much an advocate of medical marijuana. I think it's a good thing to have drugs that grow on trees that have lower side effects than the drugs that cost, you know, $5 a pill that do the same thing. The bill taxes at $10 a square foot currently the plots that are used to grow marijuana, and that's $250 a year. That's not horrible for that 25 square foot plot, although obviously it does increase the cost somewhat. But there's not a limit on that tax, and that could be changed at any time. And I think in the search for revenue, we've seen with cigarette taxes and alcohol taxes that sin taxes tend to be fairly popular and hard to argue against. So bottom line here is that I believe that Proposition 19, as it's currently written, might actually reduce access to medical marijuana for cancer patients, glaucoma patients, people with chronic pain. So I'm going to vote against it. Proposition 21 is a vehicle license fee at the DMV. So when you got your vehicle registration, it would go to the state parks, about $18, call it 5 cents per day for anybody who has a car registration. And what they would do with that money is basically open up the state parks and make them free again. Now, I'm a big advocate of exercise, and I do think that when you get out there in a beautiful park and you're on a trail, it's a lot easier to exercise. I do think also that for many people who are in, you know, middling financial circumstances, the cost of an annual pass or the $6 to $10 daily use fee that you pay at a park is a stopper, is going to prevent people from using the park. So I think this would be a good thing, and I plan to vote for it. Proposition 22, it sounds like it has nothing to do with health. It stops the state from raiding local funds, which the states have been doing on a regular basis, and this includes funds from the sales tax. So, for example, in our area of Santa Cruz County, and I'm not sure what the percentage is in Monterey County, but I'm sure it's similar, about 0.5% of the cost of anything you purchase, so the extra tax on whatever's taxed, 0.5% of your purchase cost currently funds 911, paramedics, road safety, and all sorts of other public health things that I think are indisputably valuable for the common good and particularly for the public health. This would ensure funding and make it harder for the state, when it's got a budget shortfall, to interfere with funding for local services like that. I think that's probably one to vote for. Prop 23, that's kind of a no-brainer. It's let's increase air pollution and contribute to global warming. It rolls back the limitations of AB 32, which was let's go back to where our emissions were in 1990. This is not a really, really lofty goal, and it would eliminate that until, let's see, unemployment dropped to less than 5.5% per year. Unfortunately, unemployment in this state hasn't been less than 5.5% a year more than 3 times since 1975, so it pretty much eliminates the emission level initiative. We voted that one in. I don't think we want to vote that one out. And obviously, air pollution and global warming are enormous contributors to public health issues. Proposition 25 is changing the budget to a simple majority. In case you haven't noticed, the level of political discourse and the, let's call it the cooperation index in government, has declined. And our current political culture is that of a big prisoner's dilemma. You are rewarded for betrayal, and you get a little reward for cooperation and a big reward if you can get the other guy to think you're cooperating and then betray him. That's what we've got, leading to a great deal of bizarre maneuvering, including a lot of unnecessary and poorly chosen projects that happen to be pet projects of someone whose vote you need. That's called pork barreling. And we need to stop that. So I think budget shortfalls with 2 or 3 months while they play around at the legislative level, and meanwhile, the hospitals, the child and adult protective services, and other really necessary public health safety net agencies are constrained, have to drop their hours, have budget shortfalls themselves, and are even letting people go because they can't make payroll. That needs to go away. Proposition 26 is somewhat similar. This would make it so that state and local fees would not be subject to a two-thirds vote, but simple majority. And again, think in terms of public health. As a small business person, when I'm confronted with a regulation, you know, I'm torn. I want to do the right thing, but I also want to make payroll and actually have something left over to take home. But businesses tend to look at, what's my lowest cost? In the case of pollution fees, if a business has a choice between investing in a clean tech solution or paying a fee, they're going to do whichever is cheaper. So if the fees aren't higher than the clean tech solution, guess what the business does? Being able to raise those fees as the solutions come online to make sure that businesses are properly incentivized is going to clean up our environment. And more, I'm becoming convinced that many of the diseases that I see are related to environmental pollution. And every day we get a new story about BPA or plastics or some other aspect of our environment that is showing up as causing diseases. So, yes, we do need to try and make sure that our businesses are rewarded for doing the right thing. Because, you know, they're not going to do the right thing otherwise, let's face it. So, I wanted to wind that up and thank you for letting me get on my little political high horse. I hope that you feel that I have sufficient standing as a health spokesperson to venture into politics, at least in terms of this level of analysis. And I welcome your feedback about whether or not this feature was something that you enjoyed. Before we go to our first call, I want to answer an email from Sharni in Australia. Sharni writes, "We have a mutual friend in Duff. I'm an Aussie with Crohn's disease, and I have 3 podcasts in my iPod from your weekly show, and I listen to them over and over again, each time hearing something different. I'm grateful to have this information so accessible." I'm going to skip over the compliments and go to the question. "I have had Crohn's disease in my mouth and on my tongue, and have found simple information on treatment to ease burning and pain sadly lacking. I suffer from inflammatory arthritis from Crohn's disease, and I have arthritis in both my small joints and my large joints, and I'm not sure which one is related to my Crohn's. I'd love to hear you explore these topics. And one final thing, I met a nurse who had been to an inflammatory bowel disease hospital in America, and they were putting Crohn's disease sufferers through a machine similar to kidney dialysis. This machine took the inflammation out of the blood and relieved many of the symptoms for the sufferers. Currently, we do not have this treatment option in Australia." Sharni, let me start with that last one. The treatment that the people were having at this hospital in America was plasmapheresis, where blood is taken out. The red cells are separated, the plasma is scrubbed, basically cleaned, and then reinserted back into your body. And this removes some of the antibodies and the inflammatory mediators that are keeping the Crohn's disease going. It's a legitimate thing to do in severe Crohn's, where your option is remove the colon. But it does have its own set of side effects, including blood clots and anemia, and it's sort of a rescue treatment rather than a good, solid, chronic therapy. With respect to the mouth ulcers, I agree that there's not a lot of good information out there, but I wanted to throw a few things out that I have found helpful. First one is, anyone with oral ulceration of no explanation that's recurrent, I usually have try a wheat-free diet. I've been amazed at how many people's oral ulcers reduce if they avoid gluten, and whether they're testing positive for gluten toxicity or not, or gluten sensitivity, I've seen it make a difference, and it's a relatively simple and quite cheap intervention. Licorice root is a nice thing to chew on, and if you don't have high blood pressure issues, a pretty safe thing to do. It sort of coats the mouth. There's also a pharmaceutical agent called sucralfate, S-U-C-R-A-L-F-A-T-E is the generic name in the United States, probably the same in Australia. This is used for people who suffer from stomach ulcers, but if you take the lozenges or the liquids and swish it around in your mouth or suck on the pills, it will coat the oral ulcers and make it easier for you to eat without pain. Liquid local anesthetics will also do the same thing, but at the expense of taking out your taste buds. So I really like the sucralfate for that. So I hope those things are good suggestions. And since you have the podcasts, you probably know that high-dose fish oil, boswellia, and curcumin are some natural anti-inflammatory agents that work well for most causes of inflammation, including the Crohn's-related arthritis. Thank you again, Sharni, and keep listening out there in Australia. We're going to go to our first caller, and that's Larry in Georgia. Larry, welcome to the program.
Dr. Dong, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've called before, and in fact, you've helped me many, many times, and I thank you so much. I'm calling to kind of give you an update of my situation and also get your take on it, too. Just a brief background about my history. I'm 62 years young. I don't have insurance. I'm a zealous anti-smoker and a teetotaler. As far as food is concerned, I try to live, you know, healthy foods. You know, I avoid all sugar, you know, very, very low salt. Blood pressure is good. Weight, maybe 10, 15 pounds overweight pushing, but I do exercise somewhat. Now, recently, I went to a local health fair. They tested my cholesterol.
Did they do that with a finger? Let me stop you, Larry. Did they prick your finger to get the blood?
No, they don't, with a needle.
They drew your blood into a tube.
They drew my blood, yes.
Okay.
And I'll also let me say, I also fasted, too, beforehand. I fasted.
Okay, good.
I know that's important, yeah. Now, here's what it came back with. Triglyceride, 64 megahertz. No, not megahertz. I mean megahertz. Milligrams, sorry.
Right.
Cholesterol, lipid, 210 says H high. HDL cholesterol, 48 milligrams. LDL, 149.0, it says H high,
mm-hmm.
milligrams. And then TC/HDL, 4.36 ratio.
And you're 61 years old and
62 years young. 62.
You have an age of 62. And your
yes.
family history is
yes.
for heart disease is what?
Good question. My dad died very young. My dad died about, he was 42 years young. I think it was a stroke. I can say he had a lot of stress. Also, dad was a heavy smoker. Someone asked me about diabetes. I can say I'm not a diabetic, but, you know, there are diabetics in my family. There were, they passed. You know, both my mother and dad were not diabetic, but family members were.
Okay, that doesn't matter, but did anyone else in your family have a heart attack or a stroke before 55 for men or 65 for women?
Good question. God, I think I'm just trying to pull this from my memory, Dr. Dawn. You know, I want to say, although I don't swear, I want to say that perhaps my father's sister, maybe.
You know, right. Maybe she did. So let me tell you why that's important. I had this talk, just exact same talk in my office yesterday. So let me do my little disclaimer, which is everything I'm about to say is based on statistics of large numbers. So
okay. We're
talking about when we say 42% risk of something, we're talking about a large group of people, say thousands of people just like you. We are not talking about you. You either have a heart attack or don't, or have a stroke or don't. For you, it's a binary event. So these percentages need to be taken as a large group statistic, as a risk statistic, and it's really important. Like today, right now, I'm looking out the window, and here in my part of California, the rain is coming down. I'm looking at down here, and it says 20% chance of rain. But rain's a binary event. It either is or isn't raining. You know, the 20% chance came true. Now, if I told you you had a 20% chance of a heart attack in the next 5 years, that means you have an 80% chance of not having a heart attack, right? But you're either going to have the heart attack or not have it. So,
yeah. That
being said, here's how the numbers parse out for you. You have three risk factors. You're a male, you're over 50, and you have a family history of early cardiovascular disease in that your father had a stroke. It doesn't matter that he was a smoker, or it doesn't matter whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That's young, and so it counts against you statistically,
mm-hmm.
and you can't talk yourself out of that risk factor.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with three risk factors, you're supposed to have an LDL under 130 to have an average risk of heart disease. If your LDL is above 130, then your risk of heart disease is increased relative to the global average of people. How much is it increased? Not that much. Probably you're looking at a relative risk of 1.5, 1 1/3 relative to that population risk. If we had, let's say, 50 men just like you, exactly the same sort of risk level, and we treated them all with cholesterol-lowering drugs to get them below 130,
mm-hmm.
we would prevent one heart attack. One of those 50 men would not have a heart attack that would otherwise have had a heart attack. The other 49 would be taking the cholesterol-lowering drug and would technically have no benefit as a group.
Mm.
So it's called the number needed to treat, and it's a really interesting way of flipping the statistics, because you read that, it lowers your risk of heart attack by 30%, and that sounds like a lot. But when you realize that your risk of heart attack is 1 in 50, and it goes down by 30%, that's not as big a number. It goes, you know, from 1 in 50, if it goes down by 30%, it goes to 1 in 60, thereabouts. So it's not a huge improvement in your risk when you frame the risk that way. So you're already doing a lot of the right things. I would certainly say that you should be on a baby aspirin, unless you have ulcers or some aspirin allergy or some reason that baby...
Don't.
Yeah. So you should be on a baby aspirin. You should try and improve your HDL by improving your exercise, increasing your exercise. You could, if you wanted to, use some passive agents like oat bran to lower your LDL. You might be able to drop it by 10% by going
not
on...
Not much.
Yeah, with oat bran and something called the portfolio diet. You can look that up and get a list of things. This was a diet that was created by Dr. Willits, who's the chair of nutrition at Harvard Medical School. And he
Fantastic.
He came up with a diet that will lower your cholesterol as much as Lipitor will.
Okay.
If you got a 30% lowering in that LDL, well, you'd be, you know, in the low-risk zone.
Okay.
So you don't have to take a statin. I absolve you. Ergo te absolvo. How about that?
Okay, well, I'll try that. As I understand very quickly, eating foods that have lots of fiber will help you reduce that.
Actually, oat bran in particular is the one that gives you the by far the most bang there.
Dr. Dawn, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Let's go to Mark in Cupertino. Hello, Mark, and welcome to the program.
Hey, Dr. Dawn, how are you this morning?
Just fine.
Hey, I am a long-time fibromyalgia patient, irritable bowel, sort of a stereotypical thing, except I'm a man, not a woman. And I have recently joined Kaiser because of my company and been referred to physical medicine, and they have tapered me off of Darvocet, which is a drug that I was on for, I think, 14 years, and it controlled my pain quite well. I was able to work a full-time job and not suffer a whole lot of side effects. You know, I didn't feel loopy. I didn't feel tired. But, you know, they said that, you know, Darvocet's been shown to increase nerve sensitivity, actually, and it's being taken off the market in Europe. So one of the problems now is I am dealing with the lack of, the safety net, you know, so to speak. So if I exercise a little bit too much or if I don't get enough sleep, one night I experience a lot of pain. The next day it really affects me at work. So like a lot of folks, I can't tolerate too much non-steroidal pain meds. The acetaminophen doesn't really do it for me. I found DLPA to be very helpful. I've used the Mood Cure book. I don't know if you are familiar with those people. Have been
help me out on DLPA.
It's
I probably know what it stands for, but the initials aren't working for me.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's D-L-phenylalanine.
Okay.
And I found that to be somewhat helpful. The Mood Cure folks are people who run a clinic up in Marin, Julia Roth, sure. And they have a section on tapering from narcotics.
Yeah, phenylalanine is a precursor. It's an amino acid. It's the precursor for adrenaline and the drugs like dopamine and adrenaline and norepinephrine, which are in your brain as neurotransmitters. That's for the audience, not... Just to clarify.
Yeah, thank you.
So in using these things, have they offered you any of the combined antidepressants like Effexors or the Wellbutrin?
Yeah, I've been on Effexor for I can tell you my other drugs that I'm on. I've been on Effexor for 15 years. I'm on Lyrica, which was very helpful, and low dose of Elavil, like 20 milligrams.
Okay. Well,
on for irritable bowel, and it's been very successful with all the fish oil to really control my irritable bowel last couple of years.
Okay, so can you, now that I have the background, please tell me your question.
My question is, what else can I do for pain, and what other alternatives do you know of? I've been doing some acupuncture, started some Tai Chi, you know, doing sort of basic relaxation stuff, but, you know, I would say that the tapering off the Darvocet has been a net loss for me 3 months after because my ability to focus at work or to be, you know, available to my kids has been diminished. Now, you know, I don't want to be, a narcotic addict, but I'm also, you know, a long-term chronic pain sufferer, and I'm trying to think about, you know, what can I do from my angle to maintain functionality and not lose exercise tolerance. So, you know, I've lost exercise tolerance. I've gained about 5 pounds since August.
So on the Darvocet, Darvon, it's a, you know, it's a narcotic, and you have habituation after the amount of time you've been on it.
Yeah.
So it takes about 6 months for your physiology to actually readjust. So you're still in the readjustment phase.
Yeah.
From what you've told me, it sounds like the fibromyalgia is, you're on a pretty good set of things. There is something called Savella, which is a new drug and therefore expensive and therefore probably not on your Kaiser formulary.
Yeah.
That has, of course, its own self-serving research saying that it's the greatest thing since sliced bread for fibromyalgia. So, and I'm just saying it's out there. I'm not really advocating for it.
Are they claiming it's better than Lyrica?
Yes.
Oh,
and
wow.
It has a different mechanism of action, so they probably could both be taken. The thing is, let's play functional medicine for a moment, and let's go, why do you have fibromyalgia? What's driving that? Do you have some kind of toxicity syndrome? Do you have excess mercury in your body? Do you have a lot of fillings? Is there something that we could get rid of that might help with what is effectively a poisoning of your physiology? And you should be checked for sleep apnea. You should be.
Yeah, I do. I sleep with Flex.
With
sleep apnea.
Okay.
Machine.
Yeah. So the sleep apnea, you know, make sure that that machine is properly adjusted so you don't have any residual sleep apnea.
Okay.
And then you may have to go back on the Darvocet and just kind of accept that that's what you need. In terms of other pain medications right now, medical marijuana is legal. They won't give it to you through Kaiser.
Of course.
I don't think they will because of the institutional liability and all of that, but it's something that, anecdotally at least, fibromyalgia sufferers can find helpful. What? You mentioned that you were already on fish oil, and you know there are the other things like the turmeric and the boswellia. And this is anecdotal. I've had some people do well on a proteolytic enzyme that is called Wobenzyme. It comes from Europe.
Can you spell it?
Wobenzym. And this is purely anecdotal, but you know, obviously you can buy some and try it.
Yeah, of course.
And the effects are fairly immediate, so you could give that a shot. As far as the exercise is concerned, you need to exercise daily and increase what you do a little bit at a time each day.
Yeah.
You can't just work out a couple times a week and take the Darvocet to recover from it, which wasn't such a great idea anyway, really.
No.
I'm going to sign off. I hope some of that's helpful for you.
Any recommendations for getting tested for mercury and all that stuff? Because I've, you know.
Yeah, there's any functional medicine doctor can do that. If you go to the Institute for Functional Medicine website, which is, I think, functionalmedicine.org, functionalmedicine.org will have a list of local doctors. I mean, I'm not exactly local.
Yeah, of course.
I know there's people up where you are. So,
but you believe that anybody in that group is a reliable source of this kind of testing? Because I have, you know.
Yes, I do.
In support groups, I have friends who've been on these sort of functional medicine kicks for 15 years, and they don't have the level of improvement that I have, and they refuse to go Western, you know?
I think that refusing to go either Western or alternative is a mark of a closed mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so I'm totally a believer in hybridized therapy.
Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Wanted to take a moment and respond to Lorraine in Michigan. Hello, Dr. Don. I have an upcoming referral to a rheumatologist for a workup of dry mouth, dry eyes, and dry nose. I would appreciate knowing what workup you would recommend to rule in or out both primary and secondary Sjogren's and possible accompanying connective tissue diseases. Thank you very much for your time. Well, Lorraine, I'll go you one better. First of all, for the evaluation of Sicca syndrome, typically what is done is the usual battery of blood tests, rheumatoid factor, and an ANA with a panel on positives looking at any autoantibodies. And there's a particular profile that's associated with Sjogren's syndrome, and also a biopsy of the mucous membranes. I also recommend a vitamin D level, as with all autoimmune diseases, in light of the research and what we now know about vitamin D based on epidemiology, I'm sort of pushing anyone who has autoimmune disease to get themselves up to a level of about 45 or 50 on their 25-hydroxy vitamin D, with the idea that that is probably the sweet spot for getting whatever breaks that vitamin D can produce for the immune system active and working. And autoimmune disease is a disease of flawed breaks. The downregulation of the immune system isn't working properly. I would also strongly recommend for therapeutics the use of ear acupuncture. You can do a Google Scholar search for Richard Niemzow. That's Niemtzow. He is a past president of the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture and a military man, actually, and has done wonderful work both at Bethesda Naval Base and elsewhere on acupuncture of the ears. And one of the places that he has pioneered protocols is in the treatment of dry mouth related to people who have had radiation therapy for oral cancer and have burnt out their saliva glands from the radiation. He has good data that shows quite a lot of good response with very simple treatments of the ear. So strongly urge you to look in that direction also for your therapeutics. As the therapeutics, even once you have the diagnosis of Sjogren's, the therapeutics there are, how should I put it, not really satisfying. Let's go to Beulah in Carmel. Carmel, California, you're on the air. Hello.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about sleep. I go to sleep normally, and then I wake up every 2 hours or 3 hours or whatever. And I have been trying all the different kinds of herbal things, herbal in this country, I believe, myocalm and melatonin and everything under the sun, and none of it seems to really help. So I gave up and I went back onto Restoril, which my doctor had given me a long time ago. And the first night I took it, I had 5 hours sleep, woke up, and then had another 2 hours, and I was really wonderful. The next day I had a half a day of really being on top of myself and getting everything done. And then it was no use the next day, and after 3 days or four, I was drugged. I didn't feel sleepy, I felt drugged. And so I gave it up. Do you have any suggestions?
Well, I think that you should reduce the dose, because if you felt drugged the next day, that says to me that your body didn't fully detoxify the drug.
Mm-hmm.
And you may not have even cleared all of the previous drug from your system.
This half-life business, right?
Well, the half-life business has to do with how well your liver breaks down an agent.
Oh, okay.
And there may have been some confounding factors. Perhaps you were breaking down some alcohol, or perhaps you were metabolizing some other agent,
mm-hmm.
or maybe you're low in cofactors, or maybe your blood flow to the liver just isn't what it used to be and you don't run through drugs as well as you used to.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, those are all possibilities. It sounds to me like what you might tolerate would be smaller doses. I typically start with 7.5 milligrams in elders and go down from there. So I don't know what your doctor's dose was, but 15 is more routine, so that may be a factor.
The second day, it really didn't help very much.
Yes, and that's kind of interesting, but obviously sleep is multifactorial.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'll try that.
Yeah, try that, and I would try alternating agents. So you might want to look into getting very low dose of one of the antidepressants. One of our earlier callers mentioned Elavil, which is amitriptyline. And I've had doses of 10 milligrams, which is 1/30th of the antidepressant dose, work quite well for sleep in elders. And you would take that one night, take the Restoril the next night, and perhaps use a different agent broken down through a different pathway the next night, all with small doses.
Oral prescription?
Well, no, some of the over-the-counter sleeping aids might work for you, or you might find that you could, on every third night, get by with your herbal magnesium, passion flower, chamomile type things. And as long as you're getting, you know, good night's sleep a good percentage of the time, you'll be better off.
Right.
And you don't want the hangover effect. So for a strategy, I would say, and you could get maybe your friendly neighborhood pharmacist. I know where you live, you actually have a friendly neighborhood pharmacist with brain cells. So you could get that person to help you look at how the drugs are broken down and choose an agent that goes through a different breakdown pathway and alternate between them.
Thank you. Could I ask you one quick question?
Sure, very quickly.
A friend was trying to get me to take a shingle shot. I don't believe that I had chickenpox as a child, although I have no way of finding out, of course.
Oh, yes, you do.
Sorry?
You can find out, and you should.
How can I find out?
It's a simple blood test called a titer, T-I-T-E-R.
Oh!
And so
I wondered vaguely about this.
Yeah, it's a varicella titer. And if you have antibodies in your blood, then you had chickenpox, possibly a subclinical case.
Oh.
And you are therefore vulnerable to zoster. If you have never had chickenpox and you are over 60, then forget it. You're not going to get shingles.
Yeah, that I understand, but I just wasn't sure. I didn't realize you could find out. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
I'll get on to that immediately.
Have a wonderful afternoon and good luck. In fact, I should wish you a good night, shouldn't I?
Yes. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's find my emails here. I had one more that I wanted to be sure to respond to. This one is from Judith, just wanting to follow up on this. Dr. Don, regarding your suggestion that the new B12 might be covered by Medicare Part D, Medicare drug exclusions include prescription vitamins and mineral products, except prenatal vitamins and fluoride, vitamin D analogs, and niacin. So, sounds like that new sublingual B12 is not a possibility. Oh, no, excuse me, it wasn't sublingual. It was a nasal spray for B12 that we spoke about last week. Anyway, sounds like you're out of luck with Medicare Part D on that one. You know, just a little, sorry, I'm going to soapbox you for a moment again, just a little thought. We live our lives in medicine by this incredibly ornate set of rules, which are completely arbitrary and non-logical. And in other countries, they have one set of rules. And here, we have a different set of rules for each insurance, and sometimes within a single insurance, there'll be subsets of rules depending on the policy that are truly undiscoverable. And the amount of wasted time and energy and money, because you have to pay people to sit there and argue over the telephone about, well, your doctor needs to change this, and well, you know, my doctor's not here, and so I'll call you back tomorrow. That's all wasted energy. That's all, you know, the sound of a giant toilet flushing as healthcare resources go down the drain unnecessarily. And like I said, I'm on the soapbox. A study was published just this week. Researchers from the Commonwealth Fund, which is a private foundation focused on evaluating healthcare policy, compared data with the U.S. and 12 other industrialized nations, and they looked at the 15-year life expectancy rate. So if you're between 45 and 65, we're talking about you, and your chances of living 15 years from your age, if you're in that age group, went up all over the world in industrialized nations, but it went up less in the United States. We lost ground in our rankings. We went from third place to 12th place in that time frame. Between 1975, when we were in third place among industrialized nations, we dropped to 12th place among industrialized nation. And it's not because there's more smoking or more obesity. Actually, compared to other industrialized nations, the rates of obesity have increased there as well. It's not due to traffic deaths. It's not due to the fact that more Americans die of homicide, because those rates have remained roughly the same in this country. So they couldn't account for this decline. So the conclusion of the researchers, and I admit that the conclusion is a bit of a reach, is because our healthcare system is inefficient and doesn't reach people when they need to be reached. And I, for one, am inclined to agree with those conclusions. And I'd throw another one up, which is the people who are being reached by our healthcare system are being overtreated. So we have both the people who aren't getting necessary healthcare services, and we have the people who are getting unnecessary, expensive healthcare services that actually lead to increased complications just by throwing the dice. Let's go to Simon in Soquel, California. Hello, Simon. Welcome to the program.
Good morning to you.
Good morning.
I heard or read or found out somewhere that glucosamine sulfate and chondroitin did zip for the maintenance of joints. What's your opinion or what's your information on that?
Well, I'd say that there are probably a bunch of different research studies that show different findings ultimately, and there's a lot of reasons for that. In fact, I have here and was wondering if I was going to get to talk about this. This in the November 2010 Atlantic, there is a really very interesting article by David Friedman called Lies, Damned Lies, and Medical Science.
And statistics.
Yes, exactly. And statistics is part of it, because yes, you can lie with statistics.
Of course.
But also there's some really interesting innate biases in our system, and one of them is that positive results have a tendency to be published more than negative results. So if you disprove a hypothesis, you're unlikely to be published, unless, of course, you're disproving a hypothesis that's unpopular, such as the idea that a nutritional supplement could help people's health. So I think there's kind of a reverse bias in our current publishing system to publish negative results on nutrition studies. And that's just, you know, that's a bias that I see. That doesn't mean that their findings aren't accurate. It does mean, however, that for every study that shows it doesn't work, how many unpublished studies show it does.
Yeah.
But let's address the issue more fundamentally. It's all in how you ask the question with research. And so one of the studies that I found most persuasive on glucosamine came out, gosh, maybe 5-10 years ago, was a study that used x-rays. And they didn't ask the people how they felt, or did their knees hurt more or less. They looked at how fast did the cartilage shrink down on the knee x-rays over 5 years in people who were on glucosamine compared to people who weren't. And they didn't tell the people reading the x-rays and making the measurements whether the people were on glucosamine or not. And, you know, given human frailty and research bias and all the other things, I thought that was a really good study, because it's something objective, more or less objective, and you're taking a ruler, and yes, there's differences in technique, and there's all sorts of other variables, and knee x-rays are not a high-resolution study for arthritis. But nevertheless, I felt persuaded that if over a 5-year period of time you showed a decreased rate of decline and that the groups had been properly randomized, which, based on reading the methods, they seem to have been, I thought that was persuasive to say that glucosamine could slow the progression of arthritis in people with knee arthritis. And from there, it's gotten generalized to all arthritis, which is a leap of faith. And so my first question about this study, which I haven't seen, would be, what were their measurements? What were their endpoints? Were they doing some kind of objective test to look at arthritis?
Yeah.
Or were they doing symptom scores? Because I'll tell you,
yeah,
if you're doing symptom scores, people's pain goes up and down so
yeah
much that you're going to have, because of the nature of statistics, you're going to have such a wide standard deviation that you're going to need 10,000 people to get past that standard deviation to actually show an effect.
Yeah.
They should have done, but probably did not do, a statistical power survey before they set up that study. Basically, the statistical power study says, what would it take in terms of a number to show a difference given whatever the standard deviation is? Am I completely Greek to you, or do you understand what
I'm
saying?
No, I understand. I mean, did they do good science, or did they just anecdote it? You know?
And how did they set it up? Because
yeah
you can set it up, that you can game a study to get results simply by what instruments you choose
right
to measure and how many people you decide to do the study in.
And that's how polls work.
That is exactly right. And so a lot of scientific studies are no more scientific than the so-called scientific polls that we hear quoted literally every day at the moment
yeah
on our through our news media.
Indeed. Well, thank you. Just one more quick thing. Do you know of the forum that can be got on the net?
Which forum is that? There
well,
are so many.
It's almost anything. I particularly was looking for a joint replacement forum
uh-huh
for a shoulder, and I Googled it in, and my mind, there's lots of information there about, you know, people's experiences with it, and et cetera, et cetera. It helps fill out.
Let me tell you, and I'm not saying anyone's doing this. I'm just going to give you a thought problem. If I was the manufacturer of shoulder prosthetics,
yeah,
I would certainly consider hiring someone to go out there as a ghost on the forums
yeah
and present themselves as a satisfied customer, and possibly 200 different satisfied customers, because with the way forums work, you could get away with that.
Of course, different
emails.
I already sniffed some of those things out. So,
well, the point is, you wouldn't be able to tell. Because the person would be coming in as, you know, Joe from Arkansas, and he would have, joea@gmail.com, and then he'd also have, you know, joeb@yahoo.com, and he'd have all these different emails, and that's what a forum is basically just your email address. So that's your identifier, and there's no limit on the number of emails you could have. So you could totally game this. If you didn't like, let's suppose you didn't like me, you could get out there. Thank you. But any doctor, you could get out there on multiple forums and just absolutely, what do they call it? There's a word for
flame it. Flame it?
Yes.
Yeah.
You could flame someone and look like a bunch of different people saying how bad this doctor was. And you could even have a conversation with yourself about the terrible experience you had. Mm-hmm. And there's no way to disprove that. No way to falsify that. The more people start relying on forums to make decisions, the more the forums are going to stop being sources of actual information and start to become themselves a form of advertising.
Yes, I just wondered, they do have the query back, you know, to particular people.
But if your full-time job is to just sit there and maintain a web presence in favor of joint replacement, it's a large corporation. They only have to hire one person to sit there and do email all day.
The world is a tissue of lies, Dr.
Well, potentially, you know, you got to ask, you know, who benefits?
Yeah, who benefits?
Who benefits? Follow the money and all of that.
Yeah.
What I recommend the use of forum for is to get ideas. And I think to get ideas is a good thing. Like, I went to the forums recently for Morgullons, which is this disease that doctors are even arguing about whether it's even a disease. And it's a chronic skin condition that may actually be a psychiatric condition, but if you scratch enough, you'll have sores.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem, is we have a real chicken and the egg phenomenon with this entity. But I thought, well, I'll go to the forums and I'll see what is being promoted as curative, because I'm sort of interested in what people are putting out there. And if you've got somebody suffering who thinks they've got it, it's like, well, how do you help a person? Because that's my job. My job is not necessarily to be, you know, a crusader after truth so much as it is to help people.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can get them to believe that they need to stop scratching, then that'll probably help them, regardless of the source of the entity, whether it's an infection or just a psychological aberrancy. It almost doesn't matter in terms of getting them better.
Just stop scratching.
Well, that takes resolution, and resolution needs to be powered by belief.
I see. Well, thank you. Very informative, as usual.
Thank you for the call. I enjoyed our discussion. Bye-bye. We've come to the end of another hour, and I want to thank you all for listening. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Please send me feedback about the political discussion at the top of the show. Liked it, didn't like it, mind my own business, whatever. I'd like to hear from you. This is Dr. Don saying so long, and stay healthy.